You might have noticed, newspapers, TV stations, and other news outlets are dropping like flies in Canada these days. Whoops, there goes another one. But that's okay, because it leaves more room for independent media, like Ravel.ca. You can join the independent media revolution too. Go to www.ravel.ca/donate.
And welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. It's Darren Kaster, your host, also being your tech today, which is why we had such a brutal, brutal cutaway right there just at the end of that theme song. But I am live in the studio with sans Stefan today, which is unfortunately, during the summer, Stefan finds things to do, because he actually has a life. I'm sure he's actually working. He's just not here. But in lieu of that, we brought some other friends into the studio with us today as well. So we're going to be hearing from a few folks. In the first section, we'll be hearing from a new friend of mine, Bethany Coogan. I have a tradition on this show of mangling people's last names, so she's nodding at me. I think I got it right.
Something like that.
Also, my local artist collective and just general, I think, activist on like anything. Like, they're just very strongly opinionated that people shouldn't be treated badly on a wide variety of topics. Jeff and Andrea as well, artists, activists, as well as musicians as well. Good morning and good afternoon. Good evening to you,
good
Jeff
morning.
And Andrea.
Thank
as well.
You for having us.
What we're going to do basically is. Because as the only professional radio person here, I will be maintaining my role as host. But what we're essentially going to do is I've asked you to sort of take ownership for each one of our three sections. So listeners of the show know how the show works. We have three sections separated by two music breaks. Jeff and Andrea have given us both of our music breaks again today because I defer to other people's music taste to prevent our audience from having to listen to club beats, which would be my choice by default. And they're also themed as well, as usual.
Not that there's anything wrong with club beats.
No, there's just, there's after midnight radio for that. Okay. So I'm actually going to go last. I have a few stories I'd like to tie together in my usual meta narrative, making stories that don't seem immediately like they have anything to do with the environment, having to do with the environment. I'll be doing that at the end of the show, and because of that, I will also leave it slightly mysterious how I'm going to be doing that for. Jeff and Andrea will be going in the middle section. I understand we're going to be talking about a bunch of art, of course. We're also going to get into recycled materials, palm oil, a bunch of other cool stuff as well. But Bethany is going to go first. So my understanding is that we're going to talk a little bit about Elizabeth May. She's in the news right now for a surprisingly controversial reason. And I want to talk a little bit about the politics of that. We'll get into that as well. And we're also going to talk about mining. But I think we decided we're going to do mining second because that will tie into something that Andrea and Jeff want to talk about. So, Bethany, would you kindly start us off? First of all, please introduce yourself a little bit. And then please start us off a little bit on this Elizabeth May story.
Good morning, everyone. So my name is Bethany Keowen, actually.
So close. It wouldn't have been the show if I'd gotten it absolutely right. So.
And I'm a student here in Toronto and an environmental activist as well. The first kind of topic that I want to touch on is Elizabeth May potentially stepping down as leader of the Green Party. And this is over a decision that was reached at a policy convention about 2 weeks ago now, where the members voted in favor of a resolution supporting boycotting, divestment, and sanctions targeted at Israel. So there are a lot of issues that Elizabeth May wants to be talking about with Canadians, and this, she's decided, isn't one of them. So I guess it's just a bit of a political hot potato that she doesn't want to touch, and she's decided that unless this decision is overturned, that she won't be heading the party. So she's actually on vacation right now with some family in Nova Scotia, thinking about steps forward, and there's set to be an emergency meeting of the party early next week, where they'll kind of look at ways forward.
Mm-hmm. And so a couple of the standout details here as well was, of course, that the party itself voted to back a boycott of Israel over the occupation of Palestinian land. That, of course, is a it's almost like the go-to example. I forget what that word is. Stefan brings it up. But like, there's an expression for when somebody goes straight to like making a metaphor to compare something to Nazis. I feel like in Canadian or in North American politics, that's like this is the real version of that, where this is the 11 that you compare things to is this sort of is this issue. And there's nobody that doesn't have a strong opinion about this, but it's a very messy issue. And sort of because of that and because it's off topic, we're not going to get into debating the issue itself. But my initial comment, and I'd love to know what you guys thought, and Bethany will have more as well about that, is just the idea that I'm sort of surprised that she's surprised that she has to like take a point on something other than the environment. You are a party leader. And so while I completely sympathize with her, you know, with her position of having to take an official position on this issue, because it's basically like political arsenic for anybody, mm-hmm. at the same point, you're a party leader. That's kind of your job. And if you weren't ready to do that job, if you didn't want to be party leader to talk about anything other than the environment, I mean, her whole claim for the last decade has been, not the last decade, but you know what I mean, has been essentially that, you know, the Green Party isn't a one-issue party. Well, right now she's making a really good case that it is, or at least it is as far as she's concerned. So, Bethany, we'll start back with you, but I'd like to know what people just think about that angle. How do you feel about her taking this sort of this way out over this issue?
Well, that's definitely an interesting way to look at it. Whenever I found out about the news, I kind of sided with her, and I thought, yeah, this isn't an issue probably that the Green Party needs to be focusing on. First of all, international relations, I would not say is sort of a party strength. But aside from that, this I don't see as being a fruitful conversation. And just because it's so divisive, I don't think that there is a right side to be taken. I suppose as someone that doesn't think in a politically strategic manner, I definitely sided with Elizabeth in that this isn't the best way to sort of spend your time talking with Canadians. But as a leader, I suppose you're right to say that sometimes you need to face the hard issues, and this is one that's come up that she's not willing to deal with.
Sure. Well, and I mean, look at the conversation we're listening to between the Republicans and Democrats in the U.S. right now, saying that, you know, certain people aren't, you know, qualified to lead. Well, you know, if her immediate reaction to a difficult issue is, I don't want to be involved, you were asking us last year to make you the head of the country. Now, mm-hmm. nobody, including you, thought that was going to be true, but you were asking to be the head of the country. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I have to say I'm really disappointed.
I mean, I could also see it as a way of her trying to shift sort of the political narrative by deciding that, you know, she's not going to spend her energy on this. It's kind of a way of not falling susceptible to these really divisive issues that, yeah.
That like, could become a distraction.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I have more to say about everything. So why don't Jeff and Andrea jump in on this?
Well, I'm not sure why they voted on this issue at this time. I'm not clear on that. I do question, was there not an opportunity to head that decision and find the green angle?
Mm-hmm. Well, what May said was different about this was that at this convention, they went by quite strict rules of order, whereas normally any decision is reached by consensus. Mm-hmm. So her take on it was that there was a unique non-opportunity to sort of discuss it and come to a consensus decision. Mm-hmm. So barring the opportunity to kind of call an emergency vote, she doesn't have any special power to rescind this.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what do you guys think of my sort of my angle on this, though? I mean, I think we all sympathize with her personally, but, you know, as a political figure, am I off base sort of wagging my finger at her or being a little bit disappointed, or are you sympathetic to that argument, or do you sort of sympathize with that angle politically, that this might be, well, you can understand her feeling that way, that this might be bad for the Green Party, her choice, now that she's been in the position of having to have a position on this. Do you agree that she took the right way out, Jeff, or do you think maybe she could have handled it better?
Perhaps she could have handled it a little bit better, but I have pretty strong feelings about that. I support the boycott, and I support some more conversation about it as why does it exist in the first place, and what has Israel been perpetrating for however long now? You know, it's been a brutality on the Palestinian population. Mm. We continue to support Israel as a state, even though they are continuing to bulldoze and build more settlements illegally. Someone has to make a stand towards that. And I think that there could be a bit more political will in the world to maybe stand up to that and question that, because it's a difficult conversation and it is very divisive. But, you know, somebody needs to support the Palestinians in this in this discussion, I think, and more on an international level than is being done right now.
Well, and as much as I said I didn't want to get into it, I don't think it's getting off topic to say that, you know, it was. And the way I'll tie this back to the environment would be is that the Green Party has essentially made its brand on taking on an issue that's politically unpopular, but popular with Canadians, right? So, you know, there's an environmental issue that's not being addressed. The major partners aren't addressing it, so we're going to address it, right? And we're going to take an issue that's popular with the public and make that political. So, and part of the way that you have to do that is by reframing it, right? Everyone was either saying there's no problem or we're already dealing with it. And they said, no, we're not. They take control of that conversation and say, great, glad you're talking about it, but no, you're not dealing with it. And yes, it is a problem. And so taking control of a narrative is sort of, it would seem to me to be something that they're pretty used to. And so, again, without sort of getting into the, you know, who's responsible for what and where does blame lie part of it, the thing to me that surprises me is that there seemed like a really easy, perfect opportunity to do the exact same thing, which is to say, hey, okay, yes, this is a complicated issue. We do need to have more conversations about this. But it is simply false to say that, you know, being opposing the Israel government is to be opposed to it, to Jews or Israelis. That is utter nonsense. That's obvious nonsense. And the counterattack to that, to make that statement, to say, you know, this is complicated, we do need to talk more, but here's something people are saying which is just fictional, that's their MO. Like, that's their whole political brand. And I don't understand why it wasn't – why her immediate reaction wasn't to do that same thing, because it's her reaction on everything, which is to reframe the conversation to have to be the right thing. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I was just – I was surprised. I was surprised because it seemed like to just use the same playbook you've already been using and just apply it to this other issue. And you guys aren't, you know, strangers. First of all, you're not strangers to controversy. But second of all, you're not at risk of suddenly of becoming government anytime soon, unless something drastically changes. So I just, it really shocked me that they sort of, that she personally, that the party in the first place put her in this position, and I think that's surprising. And secondly, okay, well, if you're going to do that, at least do it in a way that frames the conversation correctly, which was, this is about the Israel government, the right wing crazy Israel government, and not the Israeli people and not Jews. Seems not only obvious, but easy, an easy thing to do that nobody, that surprisingly nobody is doing. Aren't you guys the guys that do that? I don't know. I guess that's why I'm so surprised, because there seems like there was a really easy way to deal with this.
You're right. There wasn't really, there was an opportunity for sure missed to reframe the conversation. And it seems like maybe her response was a little bit reactionary. And also she's been pretty tight-lipped in her reaction, very diplomatic, just sort of supporting the right of people to decide however they choose or to think in any direction. But she has really not touched the issue, which clearly is what she doesn't want to do. But yeah, it's not that they're a stranger to controversy, so it's interesting that she's sort of... yeah, stepped back from it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I as usual, I spend much more time talking about something than I intended to, and we're actually running short on the first section. So why don't you, Bethany, go ahead and we'll leave it there. Maybe we can come back in the bonus show if we feel like it needs to be discussed more. I think we've covered it pretty good, but let's talk about mining.
All right, right on. So whether or not you knew it, the seafloor is actually a treasure chest waiting to be plundered, and it's a Toronto company that is leading the charge on this. So there's an article right now in the National Geographic talking about this company called Nautilus Minerals. And basically, they're looking to scrape the deep sea floor for minerals, including copper, silver, any valuable deposits that they might be able to get out of there. And so National Geographic has just kind of presented what this could mean environmentally and what the company stands to gain. So right now they've leased some territory off sea, about 30 kilometers from Papua New Guinea. They're due to do a test sort of mine late 2016, and then the full project is set to ramp up by 2018. But it's really a pretty terrifying prospect because these are areas that are so understudied that we can't even project what the environmental impact will be. And so there was actually a meeting of the Seabed Authority in Jamaica last week. And the Seabed Authority is sort of a subsect of the UN, and they're in charge with protecting the ocean and coastal communities. So they're in the process of drafting some guidelines that would oversee offshore mining, or underwater mining, rather. And that should surface in the next few weeks, but it wouldn't actually be ratified for a few years. So that's a little concerning, since the project is due to ramp up later this year.
Yeah, and the thing that jumped out to me, Bethany, that I think the most was the ghastly number at it, which was $150 trillion, which is the estimated, I don't know if it was estimated accessible, or are we talking about actually hollowing out the core of the Earth? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I imagine that they're talking about, you know, immediately accessible. I'm sure there's more than $150 trillion if you scrap the entire Earth.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, to me, my immediate reaction when I see hear a number that high is, okay, we're screwed. Like, we've already lost. When there's that much money, everybody will sell out.
Totally.
So, I mean, which is not to say, you know, don't be concerned about this. It's not to say that. I don't even mean to sound as defeatist as I do, but I would recommend going immediately to damage control on this and not, you know, let's try and stop them, but let's try and get it into the rules, like certain regulations about, okay, here's how you're going to do it. Because, like, honestly, every government on Earth is going to be foaming at the mouth for that amount of resources. Yeah. And, you know, I'm just trying to be a realist about this. Am I being too harsh, Jeff? You're nodding at me, but with sort of a sad face. So
I don't think you're being too harsh at all.
I have a sad face.
No, go ahead.
I have a sad face because I just see the number that you're talking about is just like, it does spell disaster. Not enough people know about this. We're barely finding out about it. How long have the plans been underway? How many things can we do without studying it first? How many harms do we face after the profit's already been made by somebody? You know, like, I just, it's beyond my comprehension that we would go ahead with this. However,
and accountability after too.
It's
even looking at the investment that's already tied up in it. So this one Canadian company, and there are several sort of companies that are looking to do it. It's just that this one is leading the charge. The first fleet of underwater robots that they have, and it's a terrifying fleet. It's basically tanks with teeth and claws, extraction machines, and it takes three of them. Each machine is worth about $185 million. So that's just initial investment. And whenever they do start their first operation, again, set to be in 2018, they expect to be underwater for 30 months. So that's just sort of a window of the extraction potential that they see just on this one test site. And they have, I think, 19 others scouted out. And that's one company.
So scary.
Exactly. There was a comment, one of my favorite comments on the article was, a rare case in which we've figured out a way to destroy entire ecosystems before finding a way to study, catalog, or even visit them. Which is totally
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And exactly. One of the things they mentioned was one of the key areas was near the hot water vents, which is also where a whole bunch of really cool species over the last decade have been discovered as, you know, the things being able to survive in million degree temperature or whatnot. I mean, it's an absolute treasure trove. So we will have to leave it there for the first section, but I will amend my first statement just so not freak people out too much before we go to our music break, was that I think that under our current system, there's no way to put a Band-Aid on that. The only way to do it is either try and do, you know, triage afterwards, about limiting the damage, trying to force them to clean up, you know, how much of that $150 trillion can we recoup to deal with the damage? I mean, that's damage control, that's triage. Hey, does that not sound great? Here's an idea. Let's change the system. Let's do it. All right. So with that, I'm actually going to go to our music break here, and then we're not going to say anything. We're going to play it. Jeff and Andrea have got control over the next section. They will. They've chosen both of our music breaks today. They will introduce this artist after the break, and then also pre-introduce our next thing at the end of their section. So this is sort of the arts and music section coming up, starting in just 1 second. Okay. All right. Welcome back. Welcome back to the Green Majority. You're listening to Green Majority on CIUT 89.5 FM here live in Toronto, or possibly on one of our wonderful and very appreciated radio podcast syndicates all the way across the country, now into the United States as well. Our international podcast listeners all over the world, we've actually been getting some hits, including Rio. There's people at the Olympics right now listening to the Green Majority radio program. That's pretty cool. As well as our friends, our local friends here at rabble.ca. So if you enjoy the show and you haven't had enough and you want to hear what we're like when we don't have to obey CRTC rules, there's also a bonus show as well. So listen to the end of the show. Andre and Jeff have to run, unfortunately, but Bethany and I will have some fun as well. But without any other delay, Jeff and Andrea, please, by all means, start by explaining what we were just listening to.
Thank you, Darren, and thank you for having us. Jeff Doner and I, Andrea Battersby, are representing Bureau of Power and Light today, our art collective based here in Toronto. The music we just heard was from Tanya Tagak. She is an amazing Inuit artist here in Canada. The track was called Fracking. It is her translation of the Earth's Cries of Pains, as it is subjected to hydraulic fracturing. You can tell it's pretty emotional. She's an amazing artist, and this track is from her 2014 Polaris Music Prize winning album, Animism. And it's a great, this track is a great example of eco-art. Allows us to feel closer to the environment, and she's translating her activism artistically for the rest of us to bring the rest of us into it, and we'd like to focus a little bit now on eco art and what that is even.
Because we are artists, and our collective is we seek to aim to raise awareness about issues around the world, and something in particular is in the environment and finding other ways of engagement to environmental issues. And we figure art is a really effectual point of contact for people to learn about issues in the world. There's a really cool website that you can check out called greenmuseum.org, and it has a pretty comprehensive list of artists around the world who deal specifically with environmental art. And on their website, just to give a quick little thing before we go into a couple of the artists that we want to feature, what is environmental art? According to their website, it's environmental art informs and interprets nature and its processes, educates us about environmental problems, is concerned with environmental forces and materials, creating artworks affected or powered by wind, water, lightning, or even earthquakes, and reimagines our relationship with nature. So it gives us a way to emotionally connect with our environment, which is something that I think is maybe missing in a lot of the dialogue with the environment, that people know about issues. They say, yeah, we know about fracking. Yeah, we know about polluting waterways, and we know about cancer rates around industrial properties. But I find that if you don't have that emotional connection, it might not drive you to go further or to explore that or to really connect with what those issues are. So for art, in musically visual art, it's a powerful way to do that, to create an emotional connection. So now you kind of feel something. So, oh, now I get it. You know, if I hear a story, if I'm at a storytelling event and I hear someone's personal account of how this pollution is affecting their family, now I have an emotional connection. Or if I see a sculpture, if I hear a tune, like that one that we just heard of Tanya's interpretation of what the earth would sound like, or it sounds like crying because of fracking, then you have another point of contact to deal with that or connect with that particular issue. We had the pleasure in the last month of connecting with an artist, Tibetan contemporary artist, Tashi Norbu. We co-produced his exhibition called Time Travelers, The Art of Tashi Norbu, that took place at Gallery 1313 in August. And Tashi is an incredible artist who is exploring new ways of envisioning what Tibetan art is. And one thing that he did in particular that links to deforestation in Tibet and the palm oil industry and deforestation there. As he designed and installed, it's actually being installed next week, I believe.
Yeah, I think it's opening in the next few days.
Yeah, it's in Chicago. It's a giant 15-foot high statue of Buddha. And it's in the Grant Park Conservancy, Grant Park Skate Park, I should say. And it's made entirely of recycled and reclaimed wood. And what he wants to do with this sculpture is, first of all, have a couple really cool rails on it to be able to use your board on, which is kind of cool. But beyond that, he wants to call attention to deforestation and the palm oil industry. And deforestation is a pretty big deal. If I'm just looking at a website here, this is the Union of Concerned Scientists, Palm Oil and Global Warming and the connections in that. Current methods of palm oil production often cause the destruction of carbon-rich forests and peatlands. Deforestation and peatland drainage occur to make way for oil palm plantations. The sequestered carbon is released into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide, contributing to global warming. As demand for palm oil increases, tropical forests and peatlands and the people and species they rely on are put at risk. Certain products, like what products is palm oil in? There's lipstick, pizza dough, instant noodles, champagne, shampoo, not champagne. That would be an interesting champagne.
I wouldn't be surprised.
It's in chocolate, it's in margarine, detergent, ice cream, cookies, biodiesel, it's in soap, it's in package, but it's in a lot of...
highly processed.
Yeah, it's in a lot of things.
Things, it looks like.
Malaysia and Indonesia are two hotspots for this, and the deforestation is rampant there as it is in the Amazon basin, as it is in the Congo as well.
So unfortunately we see like profits over the environment again in this situation.
Yeah.
And the profits are kind of at the cost of our health as well, because we see all these products that have palm oil, they're heavily packaged in plastic, and they are they contain synthetics that are just not healthy for us in a multitude of ways that we're learning more and more about. Not saying that all palm oil is bad, but potentially like the way we are using it and the land we are giving up for it is just harmful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's not the product, right? There's nothing inherently wrong with
palm oil. It's the process, right?
It's
the process, and it's the complete lack of regard for the environment.
Exactly.
Not to mention for villages that are displaced around the area.
And animals.
Animal life. It's pretty horrifying. Mm-hmm. And so this example, this Buddha, this giant Buddha, it's a work of art. And you go down to the skate park in Chicago, you see this giant Buddha. You're drawn to that, of course, because it's this magnificent work of art. But then you gain some insight. Not only is a wicked work of art, it has information with it that you can now read about the deforestation and the palm oil industry. Deforestation in Tibet too, which he speaks on with this statue as well. Now you leave that park and now you've learned something because of a work of art that in your daily going about your day, you now have this point of contact that is interjected itself into your routine, which is what I love about art and what art is so powerful at doing, is creating that interjection into your life to say, hey, let's make you think differently, or let's make you aware of something that maybe you weren't before, and hopefully maybe you will go and explore that, or at the very least you are now a bit more aware of what's going on in the world. The deforestation in Tibet too, which is mainly based more around mining, which is a huge thing in especially in eastern Tibet, where they're closer to the borders with China. I say this as if Tibet were independent, which it should be. And there's a lot of illegal mining going on in Tibet. So that's a horrible thing just to think about that. But when you think, because it's illegal, there's no assessments done. There's no paperwork. There's no way of gauging the environmental destruction or damage because there's no one doing it.
We know that no foreign journalists are allowed in Tibet by the Chinese Communist government, which is a huge red flag right there. So who is even looking at what the environmental destruction is? Greenpeace has done a study, but from how far away?
Well, you know, journalists, environmental monitors are kind of like
Their satellites. They've got their
They're kind of like the hall monitors at like a frat party. Like nobody wants them there. The party's gonna be better without them. Just keep them out of here, yeah. Right? Exactly. Or a Donald Trump press conference, right? Nobody wants them here.
And you know, it's really obviously it's not in a company's best interest monetarily. To spend money on these, so obviously companies are hardly going to try to find their own way around being able to have these assessments in the first place. Yeah.
Well,
it takes forever too, right? Like,
yeah, you can't even talk about any of these issues too. I mean, we won't spend any time on it, but I just sort of, as we're passing by, I have to, you know, slap the branch that this is also regulation tourism, right? So they're not doing this in Tibet or anywhere else because, or Malaysia or wherever it might be, because that's the best place, you know, to grow this market. It's because that's a place where it can be grown that has the lowest regulation, so it can be done the lowest. And if they were forced to say, well, okay, well, let's force them to bring it back to the U.S., for instance, it wouldn't happen because it's just not a viable product. It wouldn't be in everything if they had to produce it in the U.S.
Yep.
It's only in everything because it's cheap, and it's only cheap because of regulation tourism.
Right. Exactly.
Yep. There's in another couple topics too. There's in regards to environmental art. I did mention the Green Museum. Was it greenmuseum.org? Definitely check that out because it's such a great it's such a great place to look at for to refer to more environmental artists. And you know what? There's a lot of artists that are focused on the environment, and I would love to come back and do another segment where we can focus and highlight on some more of these artists, because worldwide there's a lot of artists that are dedicating their career to the environment. And one in particular, I'll just say real quick, is in Vancouver, actually coming up, I think it's this weekend, is the Vine Arts Festival. And the Vine Arts Festival is Vancouver's newest public eco-arts festival. It's a no-fee community-oriented event where artists, performers, and audiences deepen their connections to each other on the beautiful Coast Salish landscape with an animated celebration of environmentally inspired art and performance. So that should be a cool thing if you're out in the Vancouver area.
That's really exciting, and it looks like it's their second go at it. So this is the second time they've done it. And in 2014, Jeff and I were actually lucky enough to take part a little bit in the Carbon 14 Art Festival here in Toronto, put on by Cape Farewell, which is a great organization putting together scientists and artists to tell us stories in new ways and translate scientific knowledge about climate change through art. That's what Cape Farewell does. So Carbon 14 was an art festival here in Toronto that centered around an exhibition at the ROM of many artists. We saw some eye-opening stuff there that included off-site programming. We had the great fortune to see Tanya Tagak perform at that festival, so you can tell we're fans.
Yeah.
And that was the first environmentally-based art festival in the world, apparently. That was in 2014. So now we just discovered this Vines Art Festival, and they're having their second year, and we just love to cheer them on, you know, and wish them well.
And I have to say I'm a little shocked that it was the first one of its kind, because it just seems like there's so many artists that are doing so many amazing things that are focused on the environment that this should be happening all the time. And this is something that we aim to move forward to do, is to work on producing more installations and art that is geared towards the environment and collaborating with people like yourself and other environmental activists to find and create more engaging points of contact to these issues and create more emotional connection. I think that's the key, right? It's emotionally connecting people with the issues so that they feel something, that there's something there, right? And art such a powerful way to do that.
So. Yeah, I like that as a new way of sort of approaching your activism. Sometimes it feels a little futile or like you're speaking to the crowd when you're just having discussions, which of course is important. But I love the idea of channeling that sort of energy into art in unconventional spaces and, maybe making people have more of a maybe personal or guttural connection.
And a positive spin too, right? Like,
exactly.
I mean, when we talk about the environment, it's always pretty, you know, corporations bad, pollution bad, this is horrible, this is doing – and it's true. All these things are true, but you couldn't have the tendency to kind of maybe push people away a little bit with because it can become very negative. I think art is a way of celebrating life, raising awareness about these issues, but also – celebrating that we can do something about it, and it balancing that all of those bad things with a more positive context to it, I think it would be more engaging.
It feels like people. A hopeful kind of a
approach. Yeah, it's hopeful, and so you know we can preach to the choir, and they already know. But we also need more allies. We need people who maybe aren't as connected to become more connected, and I think if it's more positive and looking at that in that context, you're more likely to gain more friends and more allyship, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is allyship?
Yeah, and we want awareness to equal action. That's what we're going for.
Yes, and awesome. And action. Yeah, awareness and of course action is ultimate. So,
all right. Well, we're running tight on time. We have just a minute left. I want to give you guys a chance to introduce the next song as well. But just before we get that, Bethany, I'm really glad you brought that up. I was thinking actually, I was having the very same thought about it, and the angle that my brain took as well is that, you know, on this show, you may not know it if the only way you know me is as a listener of this show, because I take a very cerebral approach, but I'm actually a very, very emotional person, and people that know me will say that. And I think most people can see that that's sort of what drives me to do this show, is if I didn't, if it was just a cerebral interest, I would have lost, you know, I would have gotten bored a long time ago. I have a very short attention span. Believe me, it would have taken 5 seconds if it was just that, but I have a very deep emotional, that's why I get so emotional. But my arguments, the way that I advocate for this stuff is always very cerebral. I try and be logical. I remember driving my mother crazy and her, you know, telling me I should be a lawyer, but she didn't mean it like a compliment. It was like a, you know, rah! So like that's just how I approach like things. But the thing is, like, you know, there's that I'm reminded, and I try and remind myself frequently of that saying that you can't reason someone out of a position they didn't reason themselves into, right? Yeah. And so there are certain types of people that no matter how good I am, you know, at you know, talking or just making convincing sounding arguments, it's just not going to reach some people. Right. And I think one of the,
but they might hear that one powerful tune.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they're like, wow, now I get it. You know,
what I think is so interesting about that is that sort of the effectiveness when I am effective, the effectiveness of my arguments are based on the fact that I can clearly sort of point out, you know, point A, point B, you know, A plus B equals C. It's tautology. It's, you're trying to reduce the object of any argument from a theoretical point of view, to get nerdy about arguments for a second, is to create an argument that is self-evident, right? You reduce it down to its component parts such to the point that that it cannot be resisted, because it is you're simply stating blue equals blue. That's sort of that's sort of a tautology. You're trying to reduce an effective argument is trying to be reduced down to that. But it also requires somebody to sort of follow along with your thinking patterns. And the interesting thing about art, and that was the reaction that I had, because I didn't hear that. So I never played it when you guys sent me that song. I never played it. So I was just, I heard it for the first time that the audience did, anyone that wasn't familiar with it. And it was sort of like, it's sort of, you'll get what you get from it, right? So it's not, I'm not someone saying something that I'm saying, well, here's why you're wrong. It's like you're showing someone an image, or you're giving them a sound. You're poking them right in their emotion button, and how they respond to it is up to them. And it may not always be effective, and they may not always, you know, think about the thing you wanted them to think about, but you are in fact making them think, and it's a way
and
that
react
I think
too. Like even
think
if
and
they,
react,
even
yeah.
if they're reacting, oh, I hate this or that. You know that, right? You're still connecting. You're connecting on an emotional level, or you know.
Yeah, and it has this way of going around people's sort of ideological defenses, which are geared towards deferring or diffusing or ignoring, you know, the type of arguments that I tend to make. Right. Mm-hmm. So, please do join us more often, because I'm sure there's, you know, 20% of the audience that I have zero effectiveness on. It's probably the 20% that isn't a podcast listener and just bumps onto the radio show randomly, and probably a good portion of those people that send me angry emails. But still, maybe some music will reach them.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. Just before you go, we would love to come back, and we would love to actually focus on First Nations artists here in Canada, because they're on the front lines and close to these issues, and I think that it's worth the highlight. So Yeah.
All right. So we will definitely have you back. And of course, you're not going anywhere yet. You'll stick around. You may have some stuff to say about my section. But without further ado, please interview this song and we'll go right to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So here's another here's a track from an Aboriginal artist, Chris Dirksen. She's an amazing cellist and composer. Her 2016 album was Juno nominated, called Orchestral Powwow. And she's so amazing at is braiding together traditional and contemporary training and sounds. And she's working with Tribal Spirit, which is a powwow label, the same label that A Tribe Called Red works with. So we know she's working with some really quality material and amazing artists. It's a collaborative album. And I think we're going to hear a track from it right now. Here's Chris Dirksen from the album Orchestral Powwow.
You're listening to CIUT 89.5.
All right. We are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. Might I add, is there anywhere else where you'd be hearing such interesting Canadian music, such thought and emotional provoking music, interspaced by completely cerebral arguments from me? Nowhere, I tell you, nowhere.
This is the one and only show for that.
Independent radio, yeah.
Yes.
Yes. The hallmark of a lack of a paid producer, no doubt. So we're now after making a passing attempt at making minimizing or at least putting into context the minimal or limits of the effectiveness of a cerebral argument. I'm now going to go on to make several cerebral arguments. So the first thing that jumped out at me was a story that may not, as usual, and this is usually the ones I like talking about, may not have an obvious environment angle. But believe me, I'm going to make one. Some of you may have heard that the Department of Justice in the United States recently, I'm a bit fuzzy on the details, and we're not going to go too far into them just because it's not relevant for what I want to talk about. But basically, it wasn't even a ton of prisons, but a bunch of privately owned prisons, so corporations that run correctional, quote-unquote, correctional institutions, are going to be phased out in the United States. And the reason why, and the lesson that should be but will not be learned, is why I want to talk about it. So what was happening? So we're all very familiar with this whole idea. Right-wing parties the world round love to take the idea that, privatization is the way because government is inefficient and wasteful and corporations and government or blah, blah, blah will be more efficient. We'll save money and blah, 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 blah. Well, guess what? It wasn't. So they were providing less services, worse care, increased risk to prisoners and to staff at a higher cost. And eventually, apparently they couldn't bribe enough people to get this to stay through, so it was yanked. So the reason I wanted to bring it up, and we're not going to go on for it for too long, although if someone wants to chop in with a thought, please do, but was just the idea that at least one, we've got one, I could get more, but we have one in the current headlines right now of a case, shocking, that corporations aren't better than government sometimes. And just to have a really quick sort of comment slash maybe conversation about the idea that, we just culturally have to get over this idea that that's a fiction, and it's a fiction everywhere that, governments are by definition wasteful and that corporations, privatizing stuff does stuff better. It's just not true. This is just today's example of it. And to have a conversation around what sort of the types of things, the type of conversation that Bernie Sanders was starting in the United States, about the idea that this isn't how he would have phrased it, but this is how I'll rephrase it, which was, yes, companies exist for a thing. I do not think that we should live in our own version of communist China. But it's not that simple. And there's not just it's not just American style capitalism or Chinese style. Why am I blanking on
communism?
Communism. Thank
communist
you.
Capitalism.
I kept wanting to say capitalism. Yes.
Well, they are a funny mix of both.
Yeah. And that is so. What we need to do is it's really simple. Is to just have conversations about there are certain types of things that are more appropriate and in the public interest to have run by people who do not have a financial incentive in maximizing profit. Profit being the amount you can skim off the person using that service that does not go to providing that service. So profit is the magical golden word in our society. And I think that in many cases, it should be a dirty word. I do not think that people should profit off of medical care. I do not think that people should profit off of jailing people. I do not think that people should profit off of all sorts of stuff. I don't think that there should be a firefighter industrial complex. I don't think war should be privatized. All these things are things we don't want. When we do need them, we do want them done to a certain level of quality, more important than the cost that they cost because of the societal benefits that they have. And I think we just need to have a really start having a really honest conversation about, hey, this is a lie. Like, coming back to the beginning of the show, we'll bring it full circle to my criticism of Elizabeth May on that first issue, which was, you know, don't let the other side control the message. It isn't true that corporations are better at this stuff, and stop letting them say that it is and then having an argument about this. Is government inefficient and waste money? Yes. Absolutely. You know what the solution to that is? Find ways to change the incentives to make government more efficient, not give it away to someone else who has an incentive to, you know, strip as much money out of the system as possible. I don't make a lot of YouTube comments, and this is the last thing I'll say, and I'll throw it out to you guys. I don't make a lot of YouTube comments, but I read them because sometimes apparently I'm a masochist. And I occasionally comment, usually only when I think I can make a cogent point and be snarky and sarcastic at the same time in, like, you know, Twitter length. That's the only time I generally do it. And this comment got so many, it's like a year and a half later and I'm still getting people likes on the same comment. And it was actually on a story, I forget who it was. It was probably one of the YouTube people I watched, like Secular Talk or TYT or something like that. And it was a story on, my brain's like Swiss cheese today. What are the libertarians, right? It was an argument about libertarians and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the government's so corrupt and we need all this freedom, and government is sort of by definition, government equals equal evil, just by sort of definition. And the comment I made was, I don't understand why people who can so be so fervently and mouth foamingly suspicious of government can be so blindly eager to give it to people whose motive is not to be lazy, but to rob you for as much money as possible. Yeah, they both have problems, but do you really, if you have to trust two of them, and we assume that there's no way to reform either system, are you actually telling me that the one that has an incentive to rob you prefer than the one that just has an incentive to be lazy? I don't get it. Comments, please. Bethan, you look like you're on the edge of saying something there. What are you thinking?
I mean, yeah, I'm thinking about it. I feel lucky that we're a little bit insulated from that climate, I think, in Canada. I feel like it's a bit of a different situation.
It definitely plays out in different ways, but it's
absolutely
very much here.
Yeah, but in terms of being protected from privatization, I think that there is a little bit more logical thought happening, or at least more of a communal appreciation for public ownership and not deferring to corporations, which absolutely have an interest in making profit.
And that's sort of the thing too. And I'm, as usual, I'm all over the place here with thoughts. But I mean, to bring it back again to the thing we're talking about, the Green Party at the beginning, this is another case too where people will go, you know, well, vote. I'm a liberal voter, or this is another one of my wheel holes, is about people identifying or you know, personally identifying or declaring personal allegiance with political parties. You're fools, and I don't care if you vote Conservative, Liberal, NDP, or the Green Party. You're a fool if you declare your political allegiance, because what you're saying is, I will support you no matter what you do. Mm-hmm. Now, they'll claim if pressed that's not true, but they do. They vote that way, right? And so this is what happens, right? Right now we have a liberal government in Ontario that just got rid of privatized Hydro One, right? That was a terrible idea. Does that mean the Liberals are evil? No. But does the fact that I like other stuff the Liberals do mean that I'm going to let Elizabeth... I'm just full of Swiss cheese. Help me out here.
Kathleen Wynne.
Why, yes, why did I want to say Elizabeth May again? Kathleen Wynne, thank you. You guys are really helping me out today. Does that mean that I think that Kathleen Wynne should be given a pass on other stuff? No, of course not. If you screw up, you screw up. And it has nothing to do with party you're from. And I beg of you, listener, please stop. Vote however you're going to vote, but please stop declaring yourself like a supporter of a certain party, because that's just how we get run around in circles. I don't know. It makes me
as if
mental.
It's not a fluid thing, as if you're not open to ever reconsidering another party.
Well,
I've often thought that a type of voter reform that would be really interesting is just having a ballot where you had to choose your policy platforms and there would be no party attached to it and to see what the results of that would look like.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've we've talked about sort of alternate government structures on the program before. I've proposed similar things to that, actually, in the past. The only sort of logistical issue with something like that is it would obviously require fundamentally rewriting our constitution, so it's unlikely. But I love daydreaming about stuff like that, mm-hmm. and it's frustrating that it requires a daydream. But
maybe an app or something. Yeah. It started as a game, and then
yeah. What do you guys think?
Yeah, it sounds like a PhD project or a good game. But.
So the other thing that sort of ties into that as well is the and feel free to backtrack if I inspire a thought on the last story, but another one coming out right now, of course, is the Hillary Clinton, who has was originally for the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Then Bernie Sanders forced her to say that she was against the TPP. She's now still claiming to be against it, but two devastating things have come to light, making it painfully obvious that she's full of it on that issue. One of them being that she appointed an extremely corporatist person who's been very loudly in support of the TPP as somebody basically in a position to, you know, be in charge of that file. So that's one signal to all the donors that, hey, don't worry, we got your back. We'll backflip as soon as we got this thing locked up. And the second one was another personal colleague of hers who said in an interview that, yeah, of course she'll backtrack as soon as the election's over. What are you, stupid? And then they sent him an email the next day being like, what are you doing? Shut up. And he's like, oh, yeah, no. I mean, we never talked about that. So that's of course the trouble as well too. I mean, Donald Trump was the biggest gift to corporate America ever, because they either got someone who didn't want to do the job if Donald Trump gets elected, which it's increasingly looking like that's not going to happen, but still, someone who had no interest in governing and was simply literally just going to be his style of government would be, and he's basically said as much, which is, here, do whatever you want, I'm going to go play golf. Mm-hmm. So that would have been worse, but what it's allowed to do is all the corporatist Democrats to just be like, okay, well, now it's just open season on whatever we want, because nobody's going to vote for that monster. So now there's no pressure on us to do anything. And I think this, either way, the Americans, and thereby, unfortunately, the rest of us, especially here in Canada, but just, you know, considering as the world power, I don't know, I'm feeling pretty, pretty conflicted about the next couple of years here. I mean, and, you know, not to be super depressing on the show, I think there's a number of really wonderful things happening.
Is it too late for Bernie? Is there nothing that can be done?
It is. Well,
can we have him?
I think he'll be very effective outside the stage. I mean, he's certainly not going anywhere, right? And what was really interesting is that he proved that there is you can mount a serious campaign without selling out.
And pushed Hillary's team too, right?
Yep.
Like really pushed them further.
And she may backtrack on it, but after backtracking, she'll get slaughtered by the people who have now become very politically active, because they were woken up to the fact that, hey, actually we do have power. It isn't hopeless. We didn't win this time, but we proved it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's definitely blood in the water. I'm just not sure whose it is.
Yeah. And without the corruption with the DNC and all of that too, and who knows, maybe if everything was done fairly, he may actually have been the candidate. Who knows?
Certainly a lot of shady business there. But I think we have definitely not heard the last of Bernie Sanders, and the people that are still, you know, very much in support of him and did not go, oh, okay, fine, Hillary Clinton next, are unlike in previous years and unlike in previous elections, are going to maintain being politically active, partially just because there's a lot of groups that have sprung up that have recognized this and have organized around it. Mm-hmm. And reaching out and doing that other critical thing, which we talk about on the show regularly, which was reaching out to allies, not taking 5 years to figure out, oh, white suburbanite, middle upper class, you know, group should, you know, maybe, you know, 10 years later or whatever, like we've seen with so many other movements, eventually reach out to other communities and are doing that right away and being like, mm-hmm. Let's go ally with Black Lives Matter. Let's go talk to these folks. Let's go talk to these folks. We all have grievances. They all affect all of us. We need to present a unified front for political change. I've been saying that for years, so I'll just take credit. No, there's certainly things that make me feel really, you know, gloomful. But I also, when I go and I hear what people, the response people are doing to this, and the fact that people are aware of what's going on, and doing things to respond to it and seem actually energized about the fact that they actually believe that they can. And it's not just the end is nigh guys standing on the street corner anymore, but it's young people getting up with a little bit of fire in their eyes thinking, we can actually do this. That gives me hope and lets me get to sleep at night. I don't know about you guys. So that's pretty much all the time. We've got about a minute left if anyone wants to do a quick shout out or anything, or if you want to mention your website, guys, now's the
time. Yeah, the bureauofpowerandlight.com. Check it out. We got some cool stuff on there, and we have some more cool projects in the works as well.
And you'll be coming back to join us another time as well. Mm-hmm. And Bethany, you will as well. Is there any? Do you have any websites or anything you want to shout out to?
I have nothing to push.
No, she's not selling anything. That's how you know you can trust her.
Power of love.
Awesome. Well, I'm afraid that is all the time we have. Bethany, you're going to stick around for a few minutes with me for the bonus show. We'll figure out what we're going to talk about in a
minute. Thank you for having us on.
Thank you so much to everybody for getting me through this week. And for all our listeners, thank you so much for listening, and have a good Green Week, folks. Take care.
Thank you.